Starbucks.
Whoa!
A plus, here I come.
Hey, this is Steve Nash. You're listening to CITR 101.9, the home of the UBC Thunderbirds.
Hello, I'm Farha Khan. This is Prof Talk.
Jazz music objectifies America. You know, it's an art form that can give us a painless way of understanding ourselves. The real power of jazz and the innovation of jazz is that a group of people can come together and create art, improvised art, and can negotiate their agendas with each other. And that negotiation is the art. Like you'll hear all the time, well, Bach improvised, and he did improvise, but he wasn't gonna look at the second viola and say, okay, let's play Ein Feisty Berg. they were not gonna do that. Whereas in jazz, I could get together, I could go to Milwaukee tomorrow, and it'd be three musicians. I walk into a bar at 2:30 in the morning and say, what you want to play, man? Let's play some blues. Well, all four of us are going to start playing. And I might say, doo-doo-dee, doo, and they'll say, boop, boop, doo, boop, doo, doo, boop, doo, boop, boop, doo, boop, doo, doo, boop, doo, doo, boop, doo, 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 doo. Everybody will just start comping and playing and listening, and the bass, you never know what they're going to do. So that's our art. The four of us can now have a dialogue. We can have a conversation. We can speak to each other in the language of music.
That was the voice of Wynton Marsalis, an American trumpeter and composer from New Orleans. He, like my guest today, Alan Matheson, can truly attest to the awesome power of jazz music, music that never seems to lose its cool. Jazz has been called the purest expression of American democracy, music built on individualism and compromise. It is this cool that continues to cast its spell, and as my guest today explains, jazz also has a rich and colorful history here in Canada. Jazz musicians such as Oscar Peterson, Phil Nimmons, and Russ Little are all Canadians who have brought jazz to new levels in this country. And my guest today is no exception to this. Alan Matheson is a Canadian trumpeter, pianist, composer, and arranger. He currently teaches trumpet and jazz piano at UBC and also teaches in the jazz studies programs at Vancouver Community College and Capilano College. He is the leader of his own big band, Nonet and Septet, and has played with a wide variety of local groups, including the Vancouver Opera Orchestra and the CBC Vancouver Orchestra. Alan has also directed the CBC Jazz Orchestra in broadcast tributes to Duke Ellington and Paul Whiteman. As musical director of the Festival Vancouver Big Band, Alan has conducted for Clark Terry, Phil Woods, and Bud Schenk. Alan Matheson joined me in the CITR studio. Professor Matheson, you have been described by some as a trumpeter, pianist, arranger, composer, bandleader, educator, and jazz historian, and that you do all of these things exceedingly well. This is an extraordinary description. Can you fill in for us some of your incredible feats? Oh. And where do you find the time to do all of these things?
Well, it's all time management, I think, Farha. I mean, you learn to put in a bit of time on everything every day, and it sort of depends what day it is, because, my professional music life is divided between teaching, and that can involve private lessons or teaching a classroom thing like jazz history or running a ensemble. And the professional playing seems to be everything from playing in a small jazz trio to playing larger groups or even classical music as well. So you sort of go with what you're doing at the time.
Can you give us a sort of snapshot of, say, just sort of your music career from, you know, your beginnings to now where you're at with...
Well, I feel like I've come full circle because I got involved with music. I was interested in music because I wanted to be a composer. So when I was a kid, I was about six when I started playing the piano, and that was fine. But the thing that really made me want to become a performer was discovering jazz. And I was about 9 years old, and I heard a cornet player named Bix Beiderbecke. And, you know, I knew a little bit about jazz before that because my father was in the record business. But with Bix Beiderbecke's playing, I thought, well, you can compose and play at the same time. And so that made a big impression on me. And so, you know, I started pursuing jazz as well as classical music. And where I am now is kind of interesting because I've been writing and arranging, you know, music for some time. But I've gone back to school and started a master's degree here at UBC in composition.
Wow. Now, you're also the leader of your own big band mm-hmm. in Vancouver. Can you tell us about it and also place big bands in the evolution of jazz orchestra in a historical context?
Sure. Well, we don't get to play often enough. I mean, partly that's me being often caught up with other things. And also, it's hard to economically make a big band go anywhere these days. But we do get opportunities to play, especially at Festival Vancouver, usually every year. And the band is made up of people I've been asking to play with me for, in some cases, over 20, 25 years. Like, we've known each other that long. And there's a great rapport within the group. And I think that counts for a lot, because when people come to hear us, they say, yeah, it looks like you're having a lot of fun up there. And I'm glad to hear that, because, you know, you want people to be engaged with music. And jazz is often not the most engaging music for the, you know, the new listener. And when you sort of not only hear people having fun, but see them having fun and enjoying themselves and playing, as I say, with that rapport, it really communicates to other people. I mean, I'd love to do more with that group if it was possible. So, you know, when I win the lottery, I'll let you know. But, you know, it's a lot of fun. Now, as far as big bands go, there in terms of jazz history or music, jazz history in general, they're fairly early in terms of the development. It was really dance bands in the early 1920s taking on a more jazz-oriented aspect to their written arrangements. And Paul Whiteman's band was a real pioneer in that area, as was the black band leader Fletcher Henderson, and of course Duke Ellington, who started in the mid-20s. And they, you know, were immensely popular between, say, 1935 and about 1950. They were sort of the main medium for popular music. And they kind of died out partially economically once again. But to me, I love them almost whatever era they're from, because I think jazz orchestration is an exciting sound. And I like the balance between improvised solos by individuals coupled with, you know, the rich sound you can get out of a big band.
Now, can you explain or define what is a big band or a nonet or some of these terms?
Well, a big band in jazz is usually more than 10 people. I mean, typically nowadays big bands are pretty big. They can usually be 18 to 22 people. So, you know, 5 trumpets, 4 trombones, 5 saxophones, piano, guitar, bass, drums. And some people use more or less the same configuration. And you can get, of course, a lot of sound out of a group like that, and that's an instrumentation that's evolved since the late 20s. The nonet is a 9-piece band, and the nonet that I have is partially based around the group that Miles Davis recorded the album Birth of the Cool with. Well, it became an album later on, but anyway, that band that Miles had was a little unusual for jazz because it used some standard jazz instruments like trumpet, alto sax, baritone sax, and trombone, but also French horn and tuba. And I use those instruments too, and they're great because this is one of the reasons they're great in the orchestra, you know, symphony orchestra, trumpet, I mean French horn and tuba, is that they have so much color and range. So that, you know, that's partly why that group showed up. You know, we had an opportunity to play some of the famous Miles Davis Birth of the Cool music about 11 years ago for CBC, and I just started writing more music for it, because I thought, wow, this is a great sounding group, because it's not as big as a big band, so it's easier to actually work with in some respects than 18 people. 9 is easier than 18.
Yeah. Why do you think big bands are important in jazz?
Well, you know, I think they're important because that sound draws people in, and because it's an ensemble sound, it has a repeatable aspect, which, say, a tenor sax player in front of a rhythm section trio doesn't necessarily have. Like, that can be a more abstract type of jazz playing. And most big band arranging, whether it's from, like, the last few years or back in the 20s, there's, you know, repeated melodic aspects, repeated rhythmic aspects, and especially the music of the swing era is rhythmically compelling, which is why it was popular. I mean, it was really the first youth music before rock and roll. I mean, it really set the stage for rock and roll, and they're related anyway. And I also think that big band music in the 30s and 40s especially was the main medium for people to get near jazz at all. They weren't hearing as many small groups playing long solos like they would have, say, in the 1960s or 70s. And it was a great medium because it was a dance-based medium. And the fact that, as I say, the arrangements that were written for the really top bands had so much rhythmic and melodic energy. And I think that that's still true because a lot of, you know, students, including myself, I mean, our first introduction to playing jazz was often in the high school stage band or big band, as they're called. And there's a reason why that survived. I mean, yeah, partially it's to get lots of students involved. You can have, you know, up to 25 people in a big band sort of thing. But also, I think that there's something inherent about the music that draws people together as musicians, of course, but also listeners. And, you know, we even had kind of a revival in the mid-1990s, you know, with groups like the Squirrel Nut Zippers and Cherry Popping Daddies, who were sort of doing a neo kind of swing thing and revived the sport, if you will, of swing dancing. I mean, there's like when I play gigs now, often with trad groups like Lloyd Arnson's group and the groups that I play with that play, say, Dixieland jazz or traditional jazz, we have people who are well under 40 years old out there dancing swing. They're in their 20s, actually, and it's great because I think that, not that you asked me this question, but I think that jazz, in a way, lost something when it became more abstract and moved away from being a dance medium. You know, because there's a real interesting thing when you have that communication between dancers and musicians and people, and especially on top of all that, not just dancers and musicians, but with jazz, with musicians improvising. Because, you know, a lot of the players, if you read these articles from or interviews from guys who played in those big bands in the 30s, they'd often watch the dancers while they soloed. And I find myself doing the same thing, and it sort of inspires you. You know, you sort of think a little differently, you know, because you see some great steps out on the floor, and it's relating to what you're playing, and it's kind of an amazing kind of communication.
Now, I was very intrigued by two places that you have spent a great deal of time in. The first is New Orleans, which you've lectured about as the birthplace of jazz, and the other is your connections to Scandinavia, namely Finland and Sweden. Can you tell us about your experiences and involvement in these very two different regions of the world?
Sure. Well, I'll start with New Orleans first. I mean, New Orleans is really the birthplace of jazz. I mean, I think that. And a colleague of mine, who's actually an alumnus from UBC, John Doheny, is working on his master's degree at Tulane University, and he's had me down a couple of times to work with his university jazz ensemble. And last April, we played at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, which was quite a thrill. And so, you know, I was very lucky to come down there and do some playing, and also to have a look around the Hogan Jazz Archive, which is at Tulane University, which is an amazing repository of jazz history. So that's one thing that was, you know, another thing rather that was great about going to New Orleans. And as far as Scandinavia goes, that's actually my wife, Rena Tam, who's she's a editor and writer and artist, and she her heritage is actually Estonian, and her parents came from Estonia, and Rena grew up here in Vancouver speaking Estonian, and we both like going to Finland. And so one thing with music that's so great is when you meet other musicians and you find you're of like mind, you make connections quite rapidly. And so I've been very lucky to be able to go over there a number of times to play and actually to work as well. You know, last summer I taught at a jazz camp in northeastern Finland, and also played in the Helsinki area for about a week, and I've also played over in Sweden. Yeah.
Wow. And also, can you tell us about some of the albums you have produced, and also what you're currently working on, or what, if you're expecting to, you know, to have another release down the road?
Well, I've only got one album under my name, which is with the Non-Net. It's called Entrada, okay. And I've been on other people's albums as well. I haven't done a lot of that, or as much as I'd like, but I worked with another, more of a traditional jazz band called New Orleans North, and we put out a CD about 3 years ago, which is kind of a fun record. And the other traditional jazz band I work with is Lloyd Arnson's Red Onion Rhythm Kings. And Lloyd is also an alumnus of UBC as well, although from 1949 grad class. And Lloyd is a fantastic trad jazz musician, and we put out a CD about I guess it was about 6 years ago. And in terms of current projects, right now, mostly I feel like I'm kind of busy with writing music. I would like to get a CD out of some new things by the septet and the nonet, and you know, maybe some of the new pieces that I've been writing as well.
Now, some of your professional highlights include directing the CBC Jazz Orchestra and playing with the Vancouver Orchestra and the CBC Vancouver Orchestra. And most recently, you co-hosted Hot Air on CBC Radio. Can you tell us about these experiences?
Sure. Well, the CBC things were interesting. I've done a number of projects for them. Two of them were in tribute to the pioneering big band leader Paul Whiteman, and we had a big orchestra for that. It was a big band, It was 27 people, including 10 strings. And I've also had the fortune to play as an extra, as they call it, with the Vancouver Symphony and the Vancouver Opera Orchestra. And that's always an exciting experience because, you know, it's such a great thing to be in the middle of all that. And I never, ever get jaded about doing that at all. And let's see, the last thing, you were also asking about... I think CBC Hot Air was
that?
Yeah. And I'm glad you asked because we did a tribute show recently to three Vancouver jazz musicians, Lance Harrison and Doug Parker, who also is a UBC grad, and Dave Robbins, who taught here for many years. And those three guys were real mentors of mine when I was coming up and later on too, but especially when I was in my late teens, actually. And I got to work with them and studied with Dave Robbins. And I was really glad that CBC came along and asked me to do it because in Canada we have a really bad habit of forgetting our history of all kinds. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, Aboriginal history that gets buried or other areas of culture in Canada, rather, that kind of, you know, we just don't hear about it enough. And especially with jazz, we often think in Canada, well, it all came from the States and it all came from New York and New Orleans. And yeah, that's true. But there are people up here who are really providing a great example just by doing it or by being who they were. So I was happy to, you know, be able to come on air and talk about them.
After 70 years, the CBC Radio Orchestra had its final performance at the Chan Center on November the 6th. The National Broadcast Orchestra will be its successor, and UBC has recently announced that it will play a key role as one of the founding partners. Do you believe this relationship will provide faculty at the School of Music with the opportunity to engage with the orchestra?
Hopefully, yeah. I mean, that would be great. And I think it's good that UBC is involved with this new orchestra because I think it's really important. I think that the decision by the powers that be at CBC to, you know, discontinue the radio orchestra was a serious mistake in a lot of ways because it's proven to be a very, very flexible ensemble, not just in the last few years where they've, you know, done a lot of interesting projects that spotlight, you know, the writing of Canadian singer-songwriters, but well before that. I mean, they were doing, you know, so many premieres of Canadian works and commissioning Canadian compositions that they really upheld the mandate of the corporation, I thought, really well. But if this new orchestra, you know, keeps going, I think it'll be something similar. And, you know, it is sad that door seems to be closed now, the CBC, but as they say, you know, often another door opens. And I think it's great that, you know, there's going to be this involvement with the UBC School of Music for sure.
And so how do you see your involvement?
Hard to say.
It's hard to say.
Yeah. Maybe I can write them something that they'd like to play. Who knows?
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, would you like to play a piece for us?
Sure.
A solo piece?
Sure.
All right. And what are you going to play?
Well, I'll tell you, I gave this some thought because a very dear friend of mine passed away on the weekend.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, he was 86 years old, and this was pianist Doug Parker. And Doug was, I think, one of the first people to organize a jazz group out here at UBC back in the 40s. I think he was a Bachelor of Arts grad in 1944 or 45, so he was out here really early. And he's one of those, as I say, important pioneers of Vancouver jazz who created a lot of work for people by, you know, running big bands and running small groups and writing music and arranging music. And just was a wonderful guy. And I thought I'd play something that he might like. So I think what we'll do is a piece of Duke Ellington's that was from a suite of his called Black, Brown, and Beige. And it's called Come Sunday.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. You've just heard a live performance of Alan Matheson playing Come Sunday by Duke Ellington on trumpet, recorded right here in CITR. Here's the conclusion to the interview with his thoughts on some of the challenges that student musicians encounter after graduation. So as a musician, what do you think are some of the biggest challenges that our young musicians face, especially those that graduate from the UBC School of Music?
I think the biggest challenge is the one that all of us are facing these days, is sort of the decline in live music opportunities. I think people, at the end of the day, the public values live music. They often don't know where to find it, and the venues in which to do it in a decreased somewhat over the years, although I'll say this, that the access to an audience like via the internet, etc., that's utterly changed everything since I was a student, of course, didn't exist really. And so I think for the person who's not just media savvy but also versatile, there's, you know, a chance to have a musical career. I think that it's tougher now in some ways if you're going to, say, just specialize in one thing, unless you're really, really fantastic at it. And even that, you know, you can be incredibly talented, but you have to have a bunch of things come together, like the being in the right place. This is what Duke Ellington used to say, being in the right place at the right time, doing the right thing in front of the right people. And, you know, if you're, I guess this is what's led me to where I'm at too, is doing a lot of different things. You know, if you're not just a performer, but, you know, you write music, or, you know, some people I know are also excellent music producers, you know, good sound engineers, or make albums for other people. Having some other things really helps, because, you know, you can't just necessarily do one thing anymore. And I think that, at least in Vancouver, the thing that I see, I think, is the live playing opportunities. You know, they're not in a way what they should be. And speaking of comparing to Europe, it's not the same at all. Or New Orleans. I mean, when I was in New Orleans the last time, too, it's amazing how much live music there is there. You know, and the students who were that I met who were going to Tulane, some of the better ones were, you know, they're working 5 or 6 nights a week, you know. So that's unheard of up here pretty much. And I think that, you know, you have to get good at creating opportunities for yourself as well. So, you know, you have to be, in a sense, not just media savvy, you're technology savvy, but sort of business savvy too, about, like, you know, what's unique about what it is I do? How do I continue to improve that? And also, how do I get that out in front of people?
Now, going back to my very first question, how do you find time to do so many different things?
I think I'm relatively good at time management. You know, I just, I'm using, and I tell this to the students at UBC too, I'm using the same mentality I had in college. And I used to, you know, when I was going to school, I would get kind of stressed out because I'd, you know, you'd have an exam coming or a paper due, or you had to, you know, do this, that, and the other thing. And my advice is practice first. You know, so I always put, you know, playing the piano or playing the trumpet first. You know, I try and make sure I take care of that before I take care of anything else. And that's kind of what I do. And then these days, too, because I'm trying to get a lot more music written, I kind of try and put that first, you know, because one good thing, if you're writing music, and at least you can, you know, play for a bit and then kind of work on a composition. And when you get stuck, and this is what I do. If I get stuck, I'll just start practicing something else for a while, then I'll go back and work on the tune again.
And what do you have plans for your graduate degree, which you mentioned as well, that you're doing here at UBC?
I've been pretty fortunate because I've been able to write some music in different veins. And I had a piece for string orchestra and trumpet premiered at the Chan Center on November 21st, and the UBC Chamber Strings played, and they did a great job with it. And we featured a young composer here at UBC, Eric North, on piano, and he's a phenomenal talent. I mean, he's a really wonderful composer and an excellent jazz pianist. And I've also written some choral music and some music for soprano voice and piano. And I guess the next project I've got is for pipe organ and flugelhorn, actually. And they want it to a jazz-oriented piece for organ, which will be something new for me. So that's kind of what's on my mind right now, you know. And then I'm always thinking of stuff to write for the ensembles that I work with, like the septet and the nonet. So, you know, hopefully we'll be playing in the jazz festival this summer, and we'll play some new music.
Well, it's been wonderful to speak with you, and I wish you best of luck in all of your endeavors.
Well, thank you.
Oh, one more question. What do you have any plans for the holiday season?
Yeah, I'm going to be working on this organ piece, I think. I want to get ahead on that. But mostly, I'm going to really be doing, and I've already started in on this program, is catching up on my listening, because I'm always interested in hearing new stuff. And I'm still buying CDs, by the way. So it's a whole bunch of CDs and things like that that I'm going to try and get a listen to. So that's part of it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Now, as I say, I'd like to have the gentleman come out who gave Louis his first music lessons 53 years ago, Mr. Peter Davis. Here he
is. This is him.
The old master. Mr. Davis, it's a great pleasure to meet you indeed. Now, I'd like to ask you some questions about the young Louis Armstrong. When he first arrived at your home, could you tell right away that he wanted to be a musician?
We could, yes.
How could you tell that?
Because he organized quartets, singing.
Mm-hmm.
Then he introduced dancing out there, tap dancing. The boys would clap and sing, and he'd sing and dance.
Mm-hmm.
And I was playing in a jazz band at that time. None of the other boys couldn't make it. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't make it myself.
How soon after you took lessons from Mr. Davis did you start to play professionally, Louis?
I run into Joe Oliver and those
Joe
boys,
Oliver.
And every time one of those boys would be late or couldn't make it, they'd say, go down and get little Louis. That's my name, Little Louis.
Little Louis.
And I used to sit in with those boys. Is that right, Mr. Davis?
You taught a lot of young fellas to play, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, a whole lot of them.
Many instruments, I know.
We had a wonderful brass band, and we used to go around and pass the hat. And remember, you made me leader of the little band?
Yeah, leader of the little
band. And I went into my neighborhood, you know, around where the Honky Tonks and Storyville and all them places. And all the gamblers and everything.
Yeah.
They asked Mr. Davis, I see you got little Louis in there. And say, could we give him some money, you know?
Uh-huh.
He said, that's all right. We need some instruments. And they passed the hat for me. And we had enough money to buy a whole band full of brand new instruments and everything.
You just heard an audio clip of Louis Armstrong with his instructor Peter Davis, who first taught him how to play the horn in 1912. Just prior to that, you heard an interview with Professor Alan Matheson from the UBC School of Music. This is Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM. Music on this show is from Alan Matheson's album Intrada, released in 2004. If you'd like to hear more, you can visit his homepage at www.alanmatheson.com. We'd love to hear your comments and feedback of this show, so please email us at proftalk@gmail.com or visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. You can also listen to the podcast of this show anytime on citr.ca. I'm Farah Khan. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
Hey, man, this is Big J Magnini. Man, if you want to hear all the great sounds, you got to listen to this cat, man, because this is you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, the greatest sound.